The Murder Shelf Book Club contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Listener discretion is advised.
Different people have different housekeeping standards, Bliss would say. And there have been times where I could run into stuff, but I was never totally blocked. I don't know what kind of obstacles I was encountering that day, but it was enough that we just didn't go any further. Bliss and his men used all their might, but they couldn't push their way beyond 3 feet in. Firefighter Bill Bliss, from Levi's Eyes, by Aphrodite Jones. Well, welcome to the Murder Shelf Book Club podcast. I am your host, Jill. This is episode 87, 17 Nails, part one of Levi's Eyes, A Son's Deadly Secret and His Father's Cruel Betrayal by Aphrodite Jones. I am delighted to bring you this story, which is breathtaking in its scope and attention to details. But first, we are 5 weeks away from CrimeCon, and I am looking to meet many of you in Nashville, May 31st to June 2nd, 2024. So look for me on Podcast Row, and our Patreon Zoom is coming up, so send me your book or case suggestions. All right, kicking right into our book club, I am bringing you a delicious roast garlic and pesto chicken flatbread, very similar to the one served at Murphy's Hotel in Murphy's, California, where our story begins. So you get at least two large flatbreads and spread roasted garlic over them and then put the pesto on top of that. You add a roasted or shredded chicken, like a rotisserie chicken's just fine, just cut it up, and then mozzarella and Parmesan on top. I also added some sliced marinated artichoke hearts and then diced up tomatoes. Put some basil on top. You bake at 400 for about 20 minutes until the cheese gets that nice golden color, and it is absolutely fantastic. This recipe is from thewickednoodle.com, and it is for a meal. So to use this as an appetizer at book club, you would take a pizza cutter and then divide the flatbreads into squares, and there you are. Now, the perfect wine pairing for any chicken pesto garlic combo, I have come up with Chris Baker's Willamette Valley Pinot Gris 2022 from, I'm sure you guessed it, Naked Wines. This is a complex wine with a peach, jasmine, and cherry blossom on the nose, with the palate providing a lemony twist with a little zing and then an almondy finish on the end. This is an award-winning white, and it is rich and silky in texture, and I believe it will begin our book club just perfectly. So bon appetit, murder bookies. Now, our author, Aphrodite Jones, is a pillar of true crime, and I have long been a fan of her books. I first read Cruel Sacrifice on the murder of Chandra Scherer, and that book was simply devastating. I don't think I could do it on this podcast. I don't think I'd get through it. Her best-selling true crime books have also been produced into movies, including the Academy Award-winning Boys Don't Cry, and on the Michael Peterson case, the hit Lifetime film The Staircase Murders. She has covered huge profile cases like O.J. Simpson, Casey Anthony, Michael Jackson, and she had her own show on ID, True Crime with Aphrodite Jones. The woman's knowledge, experience, talent, and her concern for victims and their families is just incredible. I am so lucky that I got to interview her, so look for part four in this series, Aphrodite in Romulus, episode 90. Such a great time chatting with her, and she's going to be at CrimeCon. So Levi's Eyes begins when Carl Carlson first sees Christina Alexander at a dance at a military base, and he was immediately drawn to this petite woman with the perfect hourglass figure wearing the polka dot dress and pumps. And before you know it, they were married, living in California, in a town, Murphy's, Christina's childhood home. Plush with giant redwood trees and grizzly bears, the local tourist attraction is Mercer Caverns, which was discovered in 1885 by Walter Mercer, which is plush with stalagmites and stalactites formed over time immemorial. Remote, Murphy's was once a gold rush mining town founded in 1844.
Fun fact.
One of the oldest continuously operating hotels in California is Murphy's Hotel, which serves our flatbread, now chic and surrounded by wine bars, which adds a very quaint atmosphere to the area. Like many other mining towns in the dry region, Murphy's was destroyed three times by flames in 1859, 1874, and 1893. By the 19th century, there was little gold left to mine, but Murphy's continued to thrive as a trading depot, bringing folks into the town. Now, moving ahead to the 1980s, Christina and Carl Carlson's family lived in a 100-year-old cabin located atop a hill, once a gold miner's chow hall. While it was badly in need of some renovations, Carl negotiated with his landlord, and he could fix it up in lieu of rent. With their three young children, Aaron, Levi, and Katie, ages 6, 5, and 4 respectively, they made it a family home. Christina made new curtains, applied fresh paint, which brightened up the place tremendously. Very practical, Chris hung a plastic bamboo shade in the bathroom. By the late 1990s, the Carlsons were integral members of the community, with Carl having a job working for Chris's dad, Art Alexander, in a sheet metal business. That Christmas, Chris made a special effort to spread holiday cheer throughout their home with angels, cinnamon-scented candles, and homemade spiced cider. The kids helped put up the Christmas tree, covered with shiny lights and a star placed on top, and it was just simply perfect. Anticipation abounded, with the kids especially sensitive to being nice and not naughty. Chris's sister, Colette, would soon arrive for the holiday with her husband and two boys in tow. Carl wasn't that excited, because he did not appreciate vying for his wife's attention, and he found Colette arrogant. But all in all, that year, 1990, their issues seemed to have bottomed out. The sisters enjoyed last-minute shopping, wrapping gifts, and looked forward to Christmas Eve with their dad, Grandpa Art. And then Christmas Day, they drive to Sacramento for dinner with their mom, Arlene, and stepdad, Randy. Chris and the kids didn't see much of Grandma Arlene, as Carl did not appreciate his mother-in-law's being a born-again Christian, who, quote, drained the life out of him, end quote. But Christmas was lovely, and when it was all over, it left Chris with a little post-holiday blues, with the cleaning up and reorganizing the new toys, and add a new Dalmatian puppy to the mix. Her hands were full. And it looked like Murphy's might get snow, a rare event in their warm climate. Carl, driving in snow, made Chris nervous, as the road to their home was treacherously windy and narrow on a good day. She warned her husband to be careful. Now, with snow pending, would Carl pick up the grocery staples of milk, eggs, and bread? Don't we all do that when it's going to snow? Growing up in New York State, Carl wasn't all that concerned about the weather, but he did agree to get the groceries and pick up a few DVDs at the video store for the kids. That's how we watched movies way back in the dark ages, you youthful murder bookies. Carl arrived home just fine, and the snow was much more than he anticipated, the kids marveling at the accumulating flakes. This was a first for them. And then they settled down to watch a movie and eat the fresh baked cookies Mom had made. On New Year's Day, 1991, the annual ritual of taking down the tree began. Carl made smiley face pancakes for breakfast and then began untangling the lights as Chris cautiously rewrapped the precious glass ornaments. Carl dragged the tree outside to a clearing, and he had a surprise for the kids. Come on, come see. Quote, burning up the Christmas tree was a ritual Carl had learned as a kid. He relished the days when his father took the big Christmas tree to the burn pile on the farm, and he loved to watch it ignite. End quote. Okay, that's certainly different. With the snow providing a safety blanket, Carl went for it. Dousing the tree with kerosene, he told the kids to stand back, and the burst of flame scared Katie and Aaron badly, with Levi's eyes huge. Why had Daddy burned up the Christmas tree? Well, Carl told them, quote, "I wanted to show you how fast a fire can start, because if this tree was still inside the house and the lights get hot enough, it could easily have started a fire, because a house can go up in an instant. It can blow up just like that," end quote. As the flames died down, a gray smoke blowing, the kids got bored and they began chucking slushy snowballs at each other. After a lunch of grilled cheese sandwiches and tomato soup, the universal favorite, Chris had plans to hang out with her best friend and watch a movie with popcorn. They'd order pizza for dinner. The kids went down for naps, and Chris went to take a bubble bath, grateful for some downtime after the hectic morning. Carl had dozed off, but was now awake. Chris had been complaining that the bedroom side of the house was cool, so he went to check the heater. Having done numerous jobs with art over the years, he thought it might be an insulation problem and grabbed a ladder, dragging it into the living room. But he wound up using a chair instead to climb up into the open attic hatch, confirming that the insulation was damaged, an easy fix. He went outside to the shed to get some copper wire, and not 5 minutes passed when he heard Chris shouting, "Carl, get the kids!" terror in her voice. Looking outside, he saw dark smoke rising from the roof vents as adrenaline shot through him. Rushing over to Levi's window, it was double locked with a screen. He smashed the hot metal, amazed that the room was already filled with acrid smoke, and he saw the flames in the hallway. Levi was curled up in a fetal position, clinging to his teddy bear. Carl grabbed him, stirring the air and making the flames whoosh. Carl would say later, quote, "It was like we were in the movie Backdraft. I grabbed Levi by the hair and I pulled him out, and then a fireball came towards us and we were both blown back off the porch." He rushed Levi to his truck, bellowing, "Get down, get on the floorboard, and keep your ass there. Do you understand? If you get out of the truck, you're dead," end quote, as Levi cowered. Later, Carl explained that he'd said some harsh things, but he wanted to make him afraid to move. Last thing he needed was Levi witnessing his mother burned, rushing out of a burning house. Returning to the girls' room, Carl realized that their window was blocked. He and Chris had just gotten new expensive bedroom furniture with a very large dresser, and now that was in the way, preventing escape. Aaron was screaming, quote, "Don't worry, Daddy is coming to get us," end quote. Struggling, Carl pushed at the dresser, eventually knocking it over. Leaning into the window, his legs dangling, he beckoned Aaron to come to him, bring her sister, with the dresser acting as a makeshift ramp. Aaron helped Katie shimmy up to Carl, who grabbed both of them, with him falling backward out the window, his body cushioning the girls from the jarring blow. Hysterical, he rushed the girls to his truck, with them joining a terrified Levi. Carl had singed off his eyebrows and burned his forehead, but it seemed the girls were all right. And again, he told them to get on the floor and stay there as the Dalmatian puppy, Lydia, appeared, being shoved into the truck with the kids. Running back to the house, Carl screamed, "Chris, can you hear me?" at the bathroom window. A plywood board was nailed over it, as earlier Chris had accidentally broken a pane of glass trying to open the stuck window. This window was positioned higher than the others in the house, and without the ladder, Carl couldn't reach, and the ladder was inside. He grabbed a piece of fence post to try to tear the screen, but it failed to help him pry the plywood free. Carl next ran to the back door, trying to enter through the laundry room, but the black smoke made it impossible, the heat too intense. He went back to the bathroom window. By now, the whole front of the house was ignited in flames, caving in on itself. Running to the truck, he drove off to try to call 911, with heads popping out of neighborhood windows to see what the commotion was about, as he screamed, quote, "My house is on fire! My wife is trapped!" end quote. Neighbors called 911 as he turned around, heading back to the orange glow atop the hill. Seeing the inferno, Carl would drive away. Later, he would say, quote, "Put yourself in my spot. Would you let your kids watch the house fall in on their mother? No, you wouldn't. You'd put the truck in gear and you'd drive away from it." End quote. When Aaron asked what about Mommy, Carl said, quote, "I think Mommy went to heaven." End quote. The first volunteer firefighter, Ken Thurston, drove up in his personal car, assessing they'd need more serious equipment. Murphy's and Vallecito fire departments had grave difficulty driving up the steep, icy road that the Carlsons lived on. When the truck began to slide backward on the ice, the driver slammed on the brakes, causing the hoses to fly off the back.
Oof.
Loading the hoses back onto the fire engine would take 5 precious minutes. Firefighter Bill Bliss and his team found the fire's heat had already reached 900 degrees. Going around to the back door where the flames were cooler, Bill Bliss struggled to get inside, being blocked. The fire chief ordered, "Surround and drown," which meant water bomb the house, and eventually the fire was beaten back. The center of the house was a pile of smoking ash, soot, and rubble. Murphy's fireman Dennis Miller located the epicenter of the fire near Levi's room, pulling down the fragile wall, revealing a white sink and a nude female body crouched in the tub, head facing the ground, a washcloth over her mouth. It was simply gruesome. The shocked children and Carl were hustled into an ambulance by EMT Pam Greet, with the traumatized kids giving short yes or no replies. Carl couldn't catch his breath and was given oxygen. Christine's father, Art, arrived, asking for his daughter, and was told she hadn't made it. Heartbroken, shocked, mental fog set in, leaving Art's memories of what transpired next hazy. His beautiful daddy's girl was gone. It was impossible. It couldn't be. At the hospital, the medical staff confirmed that the children's airways were clean, and miraculously, none had any cuts or burns. They were given popsicles, going totally silent, not a tear falling. Art hugged the kids tightly, with his best buddy, Jim Roberts, arriving. Next door, Carl was being treated, white gauze wrapped around his head, his eyes glazed over. Jim asked Carl what on earth had happened. Choking up, Carl said he'd lost the best thing in his life. Well, did he know how the fire started? Carl told Jim around 2 p.m. He was up in the attic fixing a small electrical problem, faulty wiring. After going outside to find some copper wire, he heard Chris yelling to get the kids. He filled Jim in on the harrowing rescue, with Jim wondering why he'd taken each kid separately to the truck. But Jim heard Carl slurring his words. He was drugged up. And then Carl launched into speaking about an earthquake that hit Murphy's a couple years ago, confusing the hell out of Jim. What earthquake? He didn't remember an earthquake. Carl said, quote, "Well, after that quake, that window got almost completely jammed and you could barely open it," end quote. Jim was so confused. What window? With a deep breath, Carl explained that Chris had broken the bathroom window trying to pry it open with a plunger, and he'd boarded up the window with plywood until he could find time to fix it. About a week back, Chris had gotten trapped in the bathroom. Well, Jim wondered why Chris hadn't made a run for it. Why would she stay in the bathroom for so long? It was only a few steps to the laundry room door and escape. Carl wondered if the space heater in the bathroom had caused it. He'd heard Chris hollering, and she sounded like she was in the bathroom, but he'd unplugged the space heater because it was too close to the wall. Would she have plugged it back in? Well, Carl had no idea, but he also smelled cinnamon. Maybe she had candles burning? He jumped at the window, but the window was 6 feet off the ground, and that side of the house was up on stilts. Well, Jim recognized he was getting nowhere talking to Carl, who was making no sense. The house wasn't up on stilts at all. The man was confused and had worked himself up speaking in hypotheticals. Taken to his father-in-law's, Carl was in shock. Family and close friends came by to pay their respects and to see how the kids were doing. Well, then the doorbell rang, and this time it was Howard Stolman, a fire investigator with the Ebbets Pass Fire District. Carl was overwrought, smelled like smoke, and thought it was just awful that this guy came tonight. Stolman apologized, but he needed some points clarified. And Carl began to recount the fire story once more, with Howard reading his body language, making eye contact, and listening intently. He was fixing the attic, and he'd left a drop light on the floor when he went outside. He'd only been in the shed not 10 minutes, and he had no idea how the fire got so out of control so fast. He was angry that he'd broken Levi's window, the air coming and fueling the flames. After rescuing Levi, he'd run back for the girls and then took them to his truck, which surprised the investigator. Carl had taken a lot of time running back and forth with the kids, which made no sense. Carl thought that Chris had gotten out on her own, and he feared that the kids might try to race back in, trying to rescue their cat, Lola. When he was asked about the boarded-up window, Carl explained that Chris had broken it after it jammed, and she wanted it covered with plywood until they got a new one. Stolman asked Carl what caused the fire. Well, he had no idea. Everything was fine when he was outside. But Carl suggested that maybe the space heater played a role. He knew Chris turned it on when taking a bath. Stolman asked about the kerosene heater on the front porch. Was it in use often? And sudden insight hit Carl. Quote, "Oh, wait a minute. You know, it's been so cold this week, we did use that heater. And we had a kerosene spill in the hallway, which is why I brought it outside a few days ago, right after Christmas," end quote. He said about 2 gallons had spilled, shocking Stolman. 2 gallons? Well, that's a lot of kerosene. Was there much residue? Carl thought that they had soaked it up with towels and Christmas clothes and whatever else was handy, and they used borax to get the smell out of the carpet. Riled up, talking 110 miles an hour, he paused and rethought again, and then seemed to have an aha moment. Quote, "You know, now that I think about it, there must have been traces of kerosene left, because even if you get the smell out, you probably can't get all of it, especially out of a carpet," end quote. Listening, Stolman evaluated Carl's statements, thinking they were ridiculous. No woman would use new Christmas clothes to clean up a kerosene spill. He later cross-referenced Carl's story with 6-year-old Erin, who recalled no spill and had no idea what happened to her Christmas gifts. She did remember playing leapfrog over piles of clothes in the hallway. He asked Carl why they had so much kerosene in the house. Quote, "Well, we normally don't, but Chris bought a big jug of kerosene in the house by mistake. She thought it was water," end quote. Wait, what? Carl went on to say, quote, "I had 2 5-gallon jugs on the porch, and they were both blue, and Chris got them mixed up. She brought in the wrong jug," end quote. Okay, so why would you be bringing so much water into the house? Well, in case the pipes broke to flush the toilet and stuff like that, Carl explained. Well, wait, Chris didn't know the difference between water and kerosene? Carl told him, quote, "Whenever we needed water, I'd keep it in the same jug as the kerosene because it didn't matter if there was a little bit of oil mixed in with it," end quote. Oh, boy. So they used both jugs for water or kerosene intermittently. Well, Carl said yes, now annoyed that the questions were going on and on and on. His wife died today. He had had enough of answering stupid questions, but Stolman was relentless. Quote, "Well, what became of the Christmas clothes?" end quote. Well, his response was that Chris had washed them 4 or 5 times and they were fine. She'd gotten all the kerosene out. But he admitted that some must have remained because when she put them in the dryer, the house fogged up with white smoke because it isn't vented outside. Well, wait, had the dryer been acting up? No, it just ran like this. With Carl's agitation growing, that wrapped up things for Stolman, who would wait for the California fire investigators to arrive and get Carlson's full statement on tape. Stolman mulled over the various sources of possible ignition that Carl had mentioned. So let's see. The space heater, the drop light on the rug, cinnamon candle, an electrical problem in the attic, no longer insulation problem, the dryer, and the kerosene spill in the hallway. Sounds to me like the house was a powder keg waiting to erupt into flames. Howard was having a hard time getting past the huge kerosene spill and that boarded up window. And do you believe the jug stuff, Murder Bookies? That she mixed up the jug and water and that you could mix water and kerosene and everything would be fine? What do you think? Learning of the tragedy, Carl's brother Mike and his wife Jackie headed to Galveras County, California from New York. Back when Carl and Chris were first married with two toddlers, they'd all lived in New York State. They loved Chris, who would light up a room when she entered, fitting in with the Carlsons perfectly. Jackie and Mike were simply devastated by her death, and they thanked God that Carl and the children had survived. Jackie and Mike greeted Carl and expressed their remorse. But Carl was ticked off that no one else in the family had come, especially his parents, Junior and Alice.
Oof.
Carl is a glass-empty kind of guy. Now, Junior and Alice cared, but traveling all the way from New York to California was expensive. After paying their respects to Art, the Carlsons now headed to Carl's friend's home, Bill and Patty Satterfield's, where all of them were being put up. Aunt Jackie and Uncle Mike thought the kids were too shy and too quiet, but Carl didn't seem concerned about them. Mike accepted that Carl was a narcissist, but seeing Carl so wrapped up in himself even now left even him shocked. They learned that Carl had not placed an obituary in the paper, nor called a funeral home, shirking his responsibility again. Mike asked Carl if he wanted him to go apartment hunting with him, being told that it was way too soon to think about that. He needed clothes, he needed a toothbrush, as did his children. Well, Mike asked if he should take the kids and get some new clothes. Carl fumed. Damn it, Mike was always acting like his savior and he wouldn't give him the satisfaction. And Carl shared that Art has been drinking, accusing him of not saving Chris. He had tried. He had. Mike assured him that no one was blaming him and that Carl needed to stop blaming himself. After meeting with the pastor, Carl agreed to move Chris's memorial service to a larger venue, a high school, as the whole town was also grieving. Securing the gymnasium, the next day would be Christina Carlson's memorial service. Colette was still numb with disbelief and was eager to help Carl out, setting up the floral arrangements and choral music for the service. Next, Mike, Jackie, and Carl returned to the remains of the house to see if anything had survived, which was an emotional blow to Mike and Jackie, seeing the actual devastation. A bare shell remained, with so much soot and debris, trying to identify where they stood in the house was nearly impossible. Jackie located the bathroom, opening the medicine chest, and saw all the toiletries perfectly in place, with a sinking feeling growing in her stomach. The ugly plastic bamboo shade over the window had survived the fire, too. Jackie also found Chris's Bible unscorched, with Carl saying it was a sign that Chris was looking down on them and that she would always be with them. After Carl shared a few stories about Chris winning ribbons at county fairs, he suggested they take a ride north to the Big Tree Forest to see the giant redwoods, since Mike and Jackie had never been to California before. Driving there, Carl boasted that a particular tree was so large it had been used as a dance floor, and that Chris used to take the kids up there. Now, Mike thought it was a little odd that Carl wanted to go sightseeing, but everyone copes with tragedies in his or her own way. Mike asked Carl what he planned to do, but he hadn't had time to think about that yet. Mike insisted, well, the kids would have to go back to school. And Carl replied, quote, "All I can think about is losing Chris. I mean, I just don't know how I'm going to raise three kids by myself," end quote. Mike assured him that everyone in the family was willing to help, and he saw Carl's big brown puppy dog eyes looking at him. Carl said he just wanted to go home to New York. So wait, three small kids lose their mom, their home, every possession in the world, leaving them insecure and uncertain. So now let's uproot them and move them across the country. Well, that's an interesting parenting choice. At the memorial service, Bob Monson, the battalion chief of California Fire in Calaveras County, knocked on the Satterfields' door, wanting to speak to Carl and Aaron. There was a rumor flying around that Carl planned to leave Murphy's, and Howard Stolman had already briefed Bob, who understood that there were holes in Carl's story. Clarification was needed. Carl was polite, but he resented the late-night arrival as intrusion. Couldn't he wait until tomorrow? Aaron was asleep. But Monson insisted, irritating Carl further. Since the fire, Carl had wanted to shield the kids from more trauma. He hadn't let them go to their mother's memorial service, thinking it would scar them for life. Well, Aaron came to the table in her pajamas, and Carl told her to answer every question the best she could. Fortunately, Bob Monson had a soothing voice and a kindly disposition, so soon Aaron was comfortable speaking with him. She confirmed Carl's story of how he had rescued her and Katie. Had she heard any sounds, maybe popping or bursting? But she hadn't because she was taking a nap. Had she heard Mom? Quote, "Yeah, I heard her scream just one time and that woke me up." End quote. Oh, this poor little girl. Aaron wasn't aware of any spill in the hallway, but she had seen bunches of towels and blankets, and she and her siblings had jumped over them for fun. She told Bob Monson that Daddy had burned the Christmas tree that morning. Oh, had Daddy ever done that before? No, and it was really smoky. Well, why had Daddy done that, Aaron? And she said, quote, "He wanted to show us how fast a fire could start," end quote, as she began rubbing her eyes and yawning. Well, that was enough for now, Bob thought. He would circle back another time and get deeper into this Christmas tree story. As the fire investigation continued, the autopsy came back on Christina Carlson. Found in a prone position, partially slumped over the tub, soot had completely covered her upper body and legs, which were all intact. Only the right side of her face was burned, as well as her trachea and larynx. The cause of death was simple asphyxiation caused by inhaling smoke. The manner of death, undetermined. The toxicology report would show that Chris had a blood alcohol level of 0.07, 1 point under the legal limit of intoxication, which shocked Carl. The woman barely ever touched a drink, let alone got inebriated. Colette mirrored Carl's reaction. The only drink Chris drank was a fuzzy navel, a cocktail of peach schnapps and orange juice. Was she hungover? And she planned to ask Carl, but never had the chance. After the memorial, January 5th, Carl said goodbye to Bill Satterfield, drove to the Sacramento airport with the kids, and flew to upstate New York. No announcement, no goodbyes to Art or Colette, just poof, gone. Colette was blindsided. First, Carl cheated the kids out of attending their mother's memorial service, and now he took them away from their hometown, their grandpa, their grandma, their aunt, everyone they knew. She had just lost her sister, and now her nieces and nephew were clear across the country. Carl would later insist that Mike suggested the move, that Mike arranged the trip and bought the tickets, and it was all very last minute. Going to New York to be with his family made sense, and Carl didn't trust Colette or Art, who still had that drinking problem. The fire investigation pressed onward, working meticulously, cautiously, so as not to miss anything. January 8th, the California fire team, comprised of Bob Morrison, Kevin O'Mara, Carl Kent, and Scott McKinney, filed their initial report, and the most significant findings were 1. A slightly charred piece of plywood covering the bathroom window was hammered into place with 17 nails. 2. A cardboard box in the hallway filled with clothing was saturated with kerosene. Hadn't Carl said she washed the clothes 3 or 4 times and got rid of the kerosene? 3. 4 smoke detectors were found melted into the carpet and had no batteries. 4. The burn patterns indicated the fire was centralized in the hallway. Okay. Carl and the kids went to stay with his parents, Junior and Alice, at their log cabin home in Romulus, where it was quite cramped. Knowing the kids had been traumatized, Carl's 5 brothers and sister Loretta swept in to help the best they could. Mike loaned Carl his station wagon, and clothes no longer being used by the cousins were collected for the kids. Loretta took Aaron, Katie, and Levi on day trips to keep them distracted. Cash and donations came in from neighbors, along with casseroles, baked cookies, and whatnot to give support. But as time moved forward, people did as well, and these contributions eventually tapered off. As reality sunk in, little Katie experienced meltdowns, crying for her mommy. Levi suffers from nightmares, that something was burning and he was running away. When Levi's nightmares continued, Carl took his son to counseling at his school, not that Carl had much faith in it. At first, Levi began to sleep better, but then became withdrawn, isolating himself. The counselor told Carl Levi was deeply mourning, and it would take time, but Carl ended the sessions. Unable to find a job, Carl was running out of money. He called Merrill Lukin, his State Farm insurance agent, and asked when he could collect. Lukin said the claim was still under review, and Carl snapped, quote, "The insurance policy is there for a reason. I just spent $6,000 on plane tickets for me, my three kids, brother, and sister-in-law, and I am flat broke. I've got funeral expenses, and it's a bitch raising three kids by myself," end quote. Well, it was out of Lukin's hands. The claim had gone up to corporate. Fuming, Carl insisted that the insurance policies were Chris's idea because she had wanted a security blanket. While Carl took the civil service exam for Seneca County, New York, figuring that with his dad's connections as superintendent of highways, he would get a job for the county in a snap. He did well on the exam and passed the physical, but Carl failed the psychological exam. And I wonder why? Well, demoralized, Carl turned to his dad for help, finding Junior unreceptive. Quote, "If you're just sitting around waiting on insurance money, you really should be ashamed of yourself. It's unearned money, and you shouldn't be counting on it," end quote. And a nasty fight ensued between father and son. Meanwhile, Romulus, New York, had a pretty bad winter, with Carl introducing his kids to snow angels, building snowmen, and ice skating, which did much to bring the kids around. But no amount of snow or icicles could replace their mommy. California fire investigator Carl Kent interviewed insurance agent Merle Lukin. Kent asked to see the insurance documents, learning that Carlson had inquired about the insurance in October of 1990. Lukin had met Mrs. Carlson in November. And the $200,000 policy, it was fairly typical. Carl had bought insurance on himself as well, so there was nothing that raised an eyebrow. Another agent had witnessed the Carlsons pay for and sign their policies, which became conditionally binding on December 19th, 2 weeks before Chris's death. Well, what did conditionally binding mean? Well, it meant that Carl and Chris still had to pass their medical exams, and if something came up, the policies could be nullified. Looking over the documentation, Carl Kent was shocked to see 5 insurance policies, one on Chris, one on Carl, and one on each of the 3 children, with Christina listed as the beneficiary on the children's policies. Kent was left wondering why 30-year-old Christina had gotten policies on her 4, 5, and 6-year-old children. Kent began producing a report on the criminal investigation against Carl Carlson, which would be presented to the Calaveras County District Attorney. He thought it would support murder charges. Carl Kent then called Carl, who claimed that Christina had wanted these policies, not him. She was the beneficiary on his and the kids' policies, and it was Merrill Lukin who suggested that they get policies on the kids. Now, this contradicted what Lukin had just told Kent earlier during their interview. Their conversation had gone like this, quote, Kent replied to Carl, "You're saying that it was Mr. Lukin who suggested you take out life insurance on the kids," with Carl confirming it was. "But at first, I was the one who made out the applications to take $50,000 policies on each kid." So wait a minute. You're telling me it was you who first applied for life insurance on your children? Well, yeah, but then it was Chris who went back and rewrote the applications, end quote.
Oh, that's some double talk.
He said that Chris thought of it as an investment for the kids. That's why she raised it from $50,000 to $100,000 on each. and Carl just went with it. And he fudged around some time before admitting that he had gone with Christina to sign the documents. But Merle Lucan had put the whole thing together. Then Carl added, quote, "Yeah, it doesn't look good. But we figured what the hell, because we could afford it," end quote. Family members had already been interviewed, bringing their suspicions of Carl to the investigators. They pointed out that by the end of 1990, there seemed to be trouble in the Carlson marriage. No one said that Chris had been abused, but Carl was controlling and could snap at her when she stepped out of line. Chris's cousin, Jan Starr, was downright afraid of Carl, could fly into a rage, and had during those weeks prior to Christmas. Jan explained that Chris wasn't allowed visitors when Carl wasn't home. All right, that is a major red mountain, isolating the victim, controlling the victim. But anyway, Jan had come over to bring the kids some Christmas cookies, and while she and Chris were having tea, Carl came home unexpectedly and was pissed to high heaven. He slammed the table so hard the teacups nearly fell off and Chris's eyes filled with tears as the kids scattered, taking cover. And that was the last time Jan had seen Chris. When Carl did not hear back from Kent, he called for an update, learning that the lab reports were still pending and it could take 8 months to review the process. With Carl flipping out, Kent asked him about the trouble light he'd been using that day. Had he turned it off before he went outside? Quote, "I was just running out for a minute, so I probably left it on. I was going to put it on the china cabinet, but there was a damn bowl on it," end quote. When asked if there was any trouble in the marriage, he said no, that he and Chris were best friends. When told that Colette had indicated there had been some arguing, he admitted that that was due to his bullheadedness. Quote, "We had a rough time about a year and a half ago. I don't remember exactly why, but I pushed her off a chair," end quote. All right, my brows raised at that answer. Carl continued, quote, "Chris was sitting on a chair and I pushed her and the chair went back. Sometimes I have a hot temper, a real hot one. So we must have been having a disagreement. It was probably something stupid," end quote. And then it suddenly occurred to Carl what the argument was about. Oh. He'd been cooking chili on a hot plate and reached for it and knocked the whole thing over, pushing Chris and Katie off the bench. That chili was really hot. All right, what do you think? Does that pass the smell test? Kent now shifted from chili back to kerosene. Carl said he bought a 5-gallon jug of kerosene the week before, but he claimed that the kerosene heater in the house wasn't working. But I thought it had been really cold, and they were using the kerosene heater. No, Carl said. He had gotten that kerosene for Art's business, not for use in his house. Now, Carl didn't know this, but Ken had already reviewed a year's worth of receipts and invoices for Art's sheet metal business, and no such purchases had been made. And Carl started moaning that he was so broke, but then blurted out, quote, "I could kick myself in the ass, because I could have made more effort for my wife," end quote. Asked what that meant, Carl elaborated that he knew from the smoke that she was dead. There'd been no screaming or yelling. And then he added, quote, "There was no pain, I guess, if that's what you want to hear," end quote. Reeling, Kent remained silent, and Carl was drawn into filling that void. Quote, "I guess it's going to be stupid to say, but if I wanted to kill her, why the hell would I save the kids?" End quote. Oh, holy moly. Well, Kent's voice failed him, and Carl continued, quote, "Let's face it, I had a $100,000 life insurance policy on all three of them, and in my opinion, if I was going to do it, I'd have let them go too. Then I wouldn't have to be a mommy. You know, if I didn't give a shit about her, I wouldn't have given a shit about the kids. So why would I bust my ass to get the kids out?" End quote. Well, Kent probed. Had any of the children seen him trying to get to the bathroom window? Carl thought that Levi may have, but wasn't sure. Adding, quote, "Why the hell would you kill your best friend? We were more than husband and wife," end quote. And then he plainly stated he had not killed Chris. A farm state insurer, Heather Gower Smalls, was a part of a senior investigative unit, having worked her way up over 15 years. Her job was to analyze the evidence gathered in the Carlson fire. Due to its severity, she had hired a forensic electrical engineer, the best in the field, Ken Buskey. The trouble light was sent to him for inspection. Now, this particular light was unique, holding a rare bulb, and Buskey ordered a case of them to aid in his testing. He compared the filaments inside the test bulbs to those inside the bulb at the fire scene, and his conclusion that while the trouble light smelled like kerosene, it was not on at the time of the fire. All right, before we get too deep into the fire investigation, the Ohio Arson School, Inc.com has identified four basic steps in analyzing the cause and evolution of a fire. One, identify the point of origin. You look for the areas that have the most damage, marked by a convergence of V pattern burn markings, and this is where the fire was most intense and destructive. Two, establishing the fire's path. Analyzing the direction of the V patterns and burn damage, the path can be deduced. Did the fire spread from room to room, or horizontally, or vertically? And this is critical in figuring out the sequence of events. Three, recognize ignition sources. Fire patterns created by different ignition sources have distinctive features, whether due to accelerants or electrical malfunctions, for example. This is used in pinpointing the cause of the fire. Four, documenting the fire's timeline. Using the analysis of the fire pattern, a timeline is established, which is pivotal in reconstructing the sequence of events on how the fire evolved over time. So, this fire scene is complex, as local authorities had compromised a lot in their investigation. January 8th, Ken Buskey walked through, not having a sense of which rooms were where. But still, Ken was able to identify a, quote, U-shaped pattern of kerosene in the hallway, a distinct horseshoe shape that Carl Kent had also made note of, indicating there had been a second pour of kerosene, end quote. A second pour? Oh. Meeting with Heather Gower Small, Ken explained his findings, drawing a diagram on a napkin to explain his conclusion about the second pour. Based on his expertise and the evidence, he could calculate the exact time of ignition based on the quantity of fuel pours in the U-shape, which occurred just minutes before the blaze ignited. Mind blown. It sure sounds like Carl set the fire that killed Christina to me. After getting permission for a face-to-face sit-down with Carl, Heather Gower Small surveyed all the California fire documentation, hundreds of photos, witness statements, and of course, Ken Buskey's official report. March 8th, she arrived at the Carlson residence in Romulus, New York, with Carl being gracious and a real conversationalist. He believed that this would be the final interview, his last barricade to getting that check. Had Miss Gower Small come to a conclusion about the cause of the fire? She replied that they were still working on it and needed a few things clarified. Placing a tape recorder between them, she asked him to draw a diagram of the house, marking doors, windows, appliances, D&W for washer and dryer, the access point to the attic, etc. What was in the attic? Carl replied that there were a bunch of 55-gallon drums, 30 boxes of their stuff, and it had been a real mess. They delved into his previous insurance coverage and into his financials. Boasting, Carl declared himself the breadwinner, and only his name was on their checking account, which is another big red relationship mountain. When had Carl paid for the policies? Well, he'd written a check during the first part of December. Heather Gower Smalls continued. He'd previously said he was certain he could afford the payments because he didn't have any bills, which confused her. Carl explained that he had filed for bankruptcy 4 years ago. And then she asked, quote, have you ever had a fire before? End quote. Well, Carl confirmed he had in 1986. A car of his had burned up. He vaguely recalled that they bought a two-door Dodge Charger on moving to New York, and it had nothing but problems. He could smell fumes every so often. He had come home from work and went in to ask Chris if she needed anything from the market, and the next thing, they looked out the window and saw flames. Moving on, she asked Carl where he kept his insurance paperwork. In the house? No, he had kept it and other important papers in a safe box in the garage. Well, that was a bit odd. Why would he keep his important documents in the garage? And Carl explained, quote, "When your house burns up, your garage doesn't normally burn," end quote. Okay, so this triggered Jill. Diving into the research you know I love, the U.S. Fire Administration, which is part of FEMA, produced a 2001 report on fires from 1989 to 1998. Remember, this fire was in 1991. Residential fires are responsible for 73% of fatalities. Fire and fire deaths in one-family homes peak midwinter, December to March, with the Carlson fire occurring in January. So that's completely normal. Fire and injury occurrences are highest between 5 p.m. and 8 p.m. Fire deaths, on the other hand, peak in the early morning hours from midnight to 7 a.m., not at 2 p.m. in the afternoon, like the Carlson fire. In 1991, nationally, there had been 478,000 fires with 3,575 deaths nationwide. California had 398 deaths. Christina Alexander Carlson was one of them. Note, California had 13.1 million deaths statewide in 1991. So that means dying in a house fire is not statistically probable. Of fire deaths, statistics tell us that women age 30, Christina's age, account for 6% of fire fatalities, the mortality rate for 30-year-old men being 8%, compared to, say, at age 85, where 43% of women and 63% of men lose their lives in a fire. Now, given this very cursory view of the data, it appears to me that the odds of 30-year-old Christina dying in a house fire at 2 p.m. in the afternoon was low, the outlier being that it happened in January. Further, more fun facts. Unknown causes account for 21% of fires, while 11% of causes were labeled suspicious. Incendiary and suspicious fires, also known as arson, have been the second leading cause of fire deaths and injuries in residences. Okay, so we're starting to figure this out. Now, the origins of the Carlson fire was in the hallway. During the 1990s, there was no change in ranking of the top three rooms for the origin of a fire: kitchen, bedrooms, lounge areas. So think living rooms, family rooms. That accounted for 45% of fire origins and 56% of deaths. Hallways, as the place of origin, do not even make the list. And Carl, while reporting garage fires can be murky, because they can be included with storage information and sometimes not included at all in residential fire reports, there were 18,000 garage fires in 1991. So a link to this report is on my blog at www.murdershelfbookclub.com. And now everyone needs to go and check the batteries in your smoke detectors right now. We all neglect this. It starts chirping. We pull it out. We don't replace it. Well, it's time to check it right now. And your carbon monoxide detectors too. So anyway, back in her hotel, Heather Gower Small contacted Carl Kent, asking if he knew about this 1986 car fire, and found out that he did not. The next day, Kent paid a visit to Chris's mother, Arlene Meltzer, to see what she knew about her daughter and Carl's financial situation. Arlene said that Carl kept Chris on a short leash And when she offered to give her daughter some money, it was refused because Carl would be furious if he found out. She said that Chris and Carl had discussed buying a piece of land Art owned, as they were going to put a trailer on it and eventually build a house. But then came the bankruptcy, and it would be 5 years before they could buy the trailer. At that time, Chris had asked her mom to pray for her. Did Arlene know anything about the car fire? Arlene said, yes, Chris mentioned something about it when they were back in New York, an engine blowing up or something. The insurance company didn't believe Carl. Quote, "And I remember asking how they could think that Carl would set fire to a car, because that's the last thing I would think of," end quote. When asked about the state of the Carlson marriage, Arlene was silent, uncertain. When she finally responded, she said, quote, "The only thing that really blew me away was what happened on the day of the memorial. I've never told this to anyone, but I heard Carl say, 'Third time's a charm.' What did that mean?" Arlene explained, "He was standing by himself when he said it, and at the time I didn't think much about it. When I got home, all I could think of was, there's a fire in a car in New York, then there's a fire here, and I said to myself, my God, what about my 3 grandchildren? End quote. "Well, that would concern me too, with a $100,000 life insurance policy on each one. Holy." Calling the New York car insurer, Kent learned the car fire was very suspicious. A brand new vehicle suddenly combusted sitting in the driveway. From the notes taken at the time, Carlson had removed his kids' car seats and a box of tools from the trunk just the day before the fire, but they'd paid the claim. Carl would say that he was screwed over by the insurer because he didn't have insurance to cover the replacement cost, and he'd taken a loss on that car. Carl had the worst luck in the world. I wonder if Carl knows Scott Peterson, because he had terrible luck too, right? So it was 2 years after Christina's death and just before Thanksgiving that Carl first saw Cindy Best at a local watering hole, JR's. Going through a painful divorce, Cindy was out with her aunt doing a little line dancing. Carl swept in and offered to buy the ladies a drink, teasing Cindy, making her blush. Cindy looked over and ranked the man before her as maybe an 8, maybe a 9, nice body, dressed in cowboy boots and a leather jacket, but she just wasn't feeling it. He, meanwhile, was already smitten. Petite, clear blue eyes, blonde hair, she reminded him of Christina. He shared that his young wife had died in a terrible house fire, and that he was a single dad to 3 small children who he'd heroically rescued, adding that he hadn't been able to save his wife. The ladies just felt terrible, but Carl didn't want their pity. Hours later, Cindy came to realize that something about Carl was drawing her in. With her Aunt Sheila bowing out, they went off to have breakfast together, chatting about their hopes and dreams. She shared that infertility had been a huge factor in her pending divorce, as her ex had really wanted a child, as Carl was already visualizing Cindy as stepmom to his brood. They spent hours together, talking, sharing, in sync in so many ways, with Cindy melting. She met the children, and they were simply adorable. Aaron and Levi polite, smiling shyly, and little Katie missing her 2 front teeth, as she just stole Cindy's heart. By now, Carl had collected the lump payment from State Farm, and it turns out that the Cal Fire and Sheriff Department just did not have a strong enough case to charge Carl, so the claim was paid. Carl had then bought a 3-bedroom house, providing a home and security for him and the kids. Eventually, he'd buy a farm. And it didn't take long before Cindy was there every night, giving the kids dinner and tucking them in, while Carl worked double shifts at the local factory. Her taking over babysitting chores had saved Carl $300 a week. When they were alone, he vented to Cindy how unlucky he was, that life wasn't fair, anxiety welling up. Now, Cindy's first husband hadn't shared with her like this, so she appreciated Carl's openness. He was good-looking, had a solid family, a good job, wonderful kids, and she felt she found her prince. That May, Art, Colette, and her kids were coming for a visit, but Cindy wasn't ready to meet Chris's family. But Carl insisted he needed Cindy by his side, and it would be a mini vacation for everyone. After Cindy cleaned the house, stocked the refrigerator, prepped the bedrooms, she wanted to leave, not to flaunt their relationship in front of Colette and Art. But she weighed Carl's wishes versus what she anticipated would be in a very emotional visit for Chris's family. And then in the end, Carl changed his mind and let her off the hook. She did eventually meet Colette and Art, and they were very polite and friendly, but focused on Aaron, Levi, and Katie. Over a cup of tea, Cindy and Colette began to get to know each other, with Cindy sharing stories of helping the kids with homework and teaching Katie to ride her two-wheeler. Carl had been a drill sergeant when Cindy met him, and she was still working on getting him to chill out, what Colette understood. The visit went well, with Colette and Carl basically getting along, and Cindy thought his concerns were blown all out of proportion. Then Carl took Colette over to see his family farm, the horses, where he took the kids riding, and it all would have been lovely, short of the braggadocio going on. Colette had forgotten how delusional Carl was. Up to the hilt with his malarkey, Colette decided to burst his bubble, and she pointed out how old the barns were, junk piled up, which probably drew rats. Blocking her exit from the barn, with a steely look in his eyes, Carl said, quote, "Do you know how an arsonist gets away with a fire? How? You douse a rat with kerosene, then light it. It always runs back to its home," end quote. "Oh my God," he said this to his deceased wife's sister, who only died in a house fire 2 years earlier. I was just horrified. Oh my God. Well, Cindy finds out that very abruptly, Art and Colette left, with Cindy never getting a chance to exchange phone numbers. And Carl kind of blew her off. They'd be back next year. But Colette did not return then, or even afterwards. And I know I'm repeating myself for the millionth time. There is so much more here. You have to read Aphrodite Jones's book, Murder Bookies. Soon, Carl was hounding Cindy to move in with him, with her resisting. She did not want another failed relationship, but he gradually wore her down. The kids adored her, loved being around Cindy, especially when she made them chocolate chip cookies. Cindy now had the kids she wanted so desperately, and she enjoyed mothering them. Carl continued to take the kids to sporting events on the weekend and tuck them in at night, but eventually he shifted this responsibility to Cindy, with him spending more and more time with the horses. When Cindy asked him to help with the kids, he complained he was too tired, had worked extra shifts, yada, 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 any excuse to get out of it. And it occurred to her that Carl cared more about the horses than he did his kids. Another red mountain. Between her waitressing, handling the house, dealing with the kids, Cindy was worn out. One morning, she woke up feeling queasy with a huge headache, thinking she had the flu. But something nagged at her, and she did a home pregnancy test, and it came back positive. It was a miracle. Carl was ecstatic and began to talk about marriage as she began her second trimester. As they began discussing dates, Cindy woke up in severe pain, the bed bloody. She had lost the baby. And in the ER, they recognized it was an ectopic pregnancy and her life was in jeopardy. After 3 days of intensive care, she pulled through and was warned to never risk another pregnancy unless through in vitro fertilization, which would still be risky. But Carl looked at her and said he wanted to get married anyway. Their no-frills wedding was simple, with Cindy making sure the kids played an important special role. Aaron and Katie wore identical flowery dresses, with Levi in a button-down shirt and tie. Cindy wore a simple white dress with a string of pearls, and Carl looked handsome in his suit. Their reception was at the Varick Firehouse, where Carl had been a volunteer for years, Dinner was potluck, with a boombox playing dance music. All their closest friends and family had a wonderful time. And then Carl whisked Cindy off to Niagara Falls. He promised to take her on a cruise for their real honeymoon. During their pillow talk, Carl revealed that he was embroiled in a nasty civil suit that was draining his bank account. The owners of the house he rented back in Murphy's were suing him for $200,000. They had been negligent, and suing him? It wasn't Carl's fault the house couldn't be insured because it was over 100 years old. Well, to Cindy, it made no sense. Carl explained that he had paid them $60,000 to make them go away, with Cindy totally sympathetic. Kicking a guy when he's down, that's just wrong. Well, due to all this, their cruise would have to wait, and Cindy understood. She believed they'd do all right. The house was paid for, their expenses would be low, and with her taking extra shifts on the weekend and Carl building horse carriages on the side, they would be fine. They saved and saved, and Carl kept his word, taking Cindy on her first cruise, where she was enraptured with the aqua blue water and luxuries. And that concludes episode 87, 17 Nails, part 1 on Levi's Eyes, A Son's Deadly Secret, and His Father's Cruel Betrayal by Aphrodite Jones. I can't wait to continue telling you this story in episode 88, A Python Spits Kerosene Upon the World, part 2. Cindy and Carl's life together takes off, but still this terrible luck that Carl has continues to follow him, causing chaos and deadly consequences. Thank you for listening, Murder Bookies. I see you as you hear me. Let's take a few minutes here and leave an awesome review that will help me make new Murder Bookies. Share your thoughts with me at jill@murdershelfbookclub.com, on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or join Patreon for $4 a month. My merch store on Spreadshop is out, so get your merch. You can find all these links at my blog. You know where that is, with sources, photographs, show notes, our snack recipe, and our wine pairing too. Always trust your gut and lock your doors and windows. With snow pending, Written and produced by Jill, all rights reserved.